Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. My name is Daniel Angrenon and I'll be your host for the hour. Today our guest is Michael Lowenthal. Michael is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University in the Department of Justice and Peace, as well as a doctoral fellow for environmental conflict at George Mason University. He holds a degree in terrorism studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, as well as degrees in international peace and conflict resolution and women and gender studies from American University in Washington, D.C. Some of his recent papers include Asymmetric Labeling of Terrorist Violence as a Matter of Statecraft Propaganda, or Why the United States Does Not Feel to Need to Explain the Assassination of Osama bin Laden, and Operation Splashback, Queering Animal Liberation Through the Contributions of Neo-Insurrectionist Queers. He has also contributed to the books Recipes for Disaster, An Anarchist Cookbook, and the Black Bloc Papers. As a bit of a side note, if any of you get a chance to hear him speak at a conference or anything, I'd highly recommend it. His presentation at the 2011 ICAST conference is sort of what inspired my passion to study state responses to animal rights activism. I'm absolutely thrilled to have him with us today. Welcome to the show, Michael Lowenthal.
Thank you.
Now, before we jump into the discussion, I was just curious to ask you about how you got interested and involved in animal rights, as well as terrorism and peace studies.
My road to doing work on animals was through other social justice activism. So I started when I was 15 working in a housing shelter outside of Philadelphia as transitional housing for people for victims of domestic violence, mostly female and their kids. I did that for a long time. I met someone and eventually did similar work doing housing for a local abortion provider, got a job working for Planned Parenthood, and through some connections I made working for Planned Parenthood over the next 7 years, I met a number of social justice organizers in the Philadelphia area. I eventually got involved in 2000 in demonstrations surrounding the Republican National Convention, which was occurring in Philadelphia, and then through that got involved in what at the time was a burgeoning anti-capitalist and anarchist movement based out of Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. And other places. The connection to animal rights came a bit later. I had been a vegan since my high school girlfriend convinced me to go vegan when I was, I guess, wherever, 18, I guess. After becoming vegan and kind of becoming aware of the intersectional nature of animal politics, I started doing some work with animal rights groups and kind of kept that interest ever since.
So I guess if we jump right into it, we look at terrorism, and it's something that unfortunately has been associated with the animal rights movement. So just to start us off, what is your perception? What is your definition of terrorism?
The definition of terrorism is really difficult. I mean, I know it's like not the best answer, but there's a quote which I really like, which is like, there's a guy named Alex Schmidt, and I believe it's his quote, and he's like said to be one of the foremost terrorism scholars. But the quote is something like, more words have been shed over debating what is terrorism than has blood been shed in the actual fight against terrorism, or something quote like that. But I think it actually bears a lot of truth in that, you know, depending on your position, people will quantify terrorism in the way in which is beneficial to them. So if you're a state that, let's say, carries out extrajudicial assassinations, bombing of civilians, or using military means against civilian populations, you're more likely to have a definition of terrorism that excludes states as an actor. If you're a non-state actor, let's say you're Hezbollah or you're the Ku Klux Klan, you're much more likely to have a looser definition of terrorism in order to exclude yourself from that definition. So I think depending on your position, depending on what interest it serves you, people are going to have wildly divergent definitions of what is terrorism. I think for me, the key components of terrorism is that it works to inspire terror. We'll get into this later, but the work of social justice activists, whether they're, you know, anti-nuclear or animal rights or anti-racist organizing, to destroy property or to economically damage a company, but yet not put that company in fear, that's a far cry from terrorism. Terrorism is doing things like flying planes into buildings. Mm-hmm. It's doing things like blowing up public transit so people are afraid to use public transit. Terrorism is things like sending people bombs in the mail so that they're afraid to do their job, burning down clinics so people are afraid to go to work. The inspiring of fear amongst the civilian population is certainly what terrorism is. Now, that being said, there's a lot of things which are included under that banner, which I think make it a bit muddier. So is sending a bomb in the mail terrorism? By most definitions, certainly. Is giving a bomb threat, which actually presents no danger, but in effect damages a building, terrorism, you know, that's when you get into more muddy questions. So I think that the answer is, as you know, unhelpful as it is that it's an extremely subjective term, and it kind of needs to be examined on a case-by-case basis, that you're going to have a very difficult time coming up with what scholars call a quote, academic consensus definition of what terrorism is. There's voluminous books about that exact question. And I think that the kind of the jury's still out. My definition would exclude social justice activists and include states, whereas most definitions by governments would exclude states and include social justice activists.
That's a really great point. I mean, it's kind of funny because the relativity of the idea of violence is kind of funny. Animal liberationists are trying to stop exploiters from treating living things as inanimate property by destroying actual inanimate property. But I mean, the way the animal and earth liberation movements are perceived by the state and by even most of the public is sort of, I guess, they interpret it as having this inherent violence or threat of violence, like you said, with bomb threats or even, say, something like an aggressive home demonstration. So how would you reconcile these sort of muddied lines in the context of the animal and earth liberation movements as peaceful?
That's certainly a really difficult part. You know, activists of all ilks want to use tactics that are effective. There's no point in using a tactic that's ineffective. So, and again, to kind of keep in mind the difference between tactics and strategies, but if you're using a tactic that's effective, just because it's effective does not make it terrorism. And I think that that's a point that's often missed in these debates. And so I think, like, when the U.S. government says Huntington Life Sciences or, you know, Company X is losing X amount of money in revenue, and, you know, that's because they're being terrorized. It's like, no, it's not because they're being terrorized. That's because they're being campaigned against effectively. Because we're effective, we as a movement, that doesn't make us violent. Because putting glue into locks of excavators and frustrating developers who rather just move on to an easier contract, if that works to break a contract between a land developer, that doesn't make it terrorism, it just makes it effective. So I think that for the animal and earth liberation movement, one of the things that's made this definition difficult to kind of hash out is the fact that these campaigns have been effective. I mean, I don't have to, like, belabor, you know, listeners on, for a, you know, vegan animal rights radio show about all the victories that have happened. But, you know, if you look from you know, Regal Rabbits to Hillgrove Kennels to the amazing campaign against Huntington Life Sciences, these campaigns, once they focus their attention on a specific breeder, have been extremely effective in combining above-ground demonstrators and clandestine sabotage and direct action. And when those are combined, when those are focused on, they can be very effective. And like I said, when a company finds it less profitable or not profitable to engage in brutal acts, and that company chooses to cut its losses and go into another industry or open up a different location, that's not because they've been terrorized. That's because they've been effectively campaigned against. Now, that being said, and I'm the first to admit, there are terroristic tactics that are used in the animal liberation campaign. I think that's certainly true. But I do not think, and I would adamantly argue against the assertion that most animal rights campaigners are using terrorism or that terrorism is even commonly used. I think you have extremely small instances where the purpose of a tactic is designed to, again, terrorize a population. Yeah, I think sending people letters in the mail that have explosives in them that don't go to a specific person, that go to an office and open up and someone blows their hand off, I think the purpose of that is to inspire fear. The purpose of that is to dissuade people from engaging in a certain business. And I think that certainly, it can be a problematized definition, but that comes close to a definition of what is terrorism. The point is to terrorize. But home demonstrations and sabotage and direct action and arson and even the use of explosives. I'm not arguing that the use of explosives is always terrorism, but these tactics certainly do not amount to terrorism. You know, whether it's explosives, arson, or using glue, it's not the tactic which makes it terrorism. It's how that tactic's applied and whether it's designed to, again, inspire fear or whether it's designed to economically hurt someone. You know, I think that that's part of the issue that's always missed, the difference between economic sabotage and something designed as terrorism.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I remember when I saw your talk, you were talking about the big history of the animal rights movement, and yes, there may have been, say, explosive used in a certain situation, but no one has been killed or seriously injured in the history of the movement.
I mean, I'm the first person to cite that claim. No one's been killed, no one's been injured. That being said, it's difficult to make those claims because, again, this is not a movement, you know, like the Ku Klux Klan that has a membership list. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there are people who align themselves politically and ideologically with an animal and earth liberation movement who have injured and killed people. That being said, that is not representative of the movement. And certainly the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front, as, you know, monikers used in network, have never been responsible for anything. The way you get into difficult definitions is when you look at the broader movements. For instance, a good example is maybe a month ago. In Italy, a cell claiming the moniker of the Informal Anarchist Federation shot and injured an Italian nuclear scientist. I can't remember his name offhand. They drove up on a moped, shot him in the kneecaps, and drove away. They did that as a protest against nuclear technology and more broadly against biotechnology and against hyperindustrialization. Now, are they considered a member of the broader animal and earth liberation movement? Well, that's a question for debate. I mean, they're not avowed members of the Earth Liberation Front or the Animal Liberation Front, but certainly the motivations which anger people about biotechnology or anger people about nuclear science are in some ways the same kind of motivations that anger people in other ways. You know, someone who will uproot genetically modified trees and someone who would shoot a nuclear scientist share some parts of an objection to industrialized society. But that doesn't mean that this movement promotes that. It doesn't mean this movement is made up of that. So I think, again, although I'm the first person in a non-nuanced, kind of more simplistic conversation to say, like, this movement has never killed anyone, because I stand behind that statement, I think that when we kind of look at a more nuanced definition of it, the lines between what is and isn't our movement become a little bit more difficult. But that being said, when you compare it to other movements, which are equally diverse, you see that it stands far apart. So to cite a more heavy-handed example, you can look at the white supremacist movement, the anti-abortion movement, the anti-immigration movement, you know, traditional quote-unquote right-wing movements, and all of those have been responsible for numerous acts of lethal violence. I mean, the anti-abortion movement has galleries of doctors and clinic workers who have been shot, killed, and otherwise injured or hurt. And that's relatively commonplace. You know, we have to remember that the attacks, the big attacks by Americans on Americans, and I know you're a Canadian show, but bear with me for a second. You know, we look at Timothy McVeigh. Timothy McVeigh was an American. He was a former military officer angry at the United States government, and he killed hundreds of people. He wasn't an anarchist. He wasn't an animal rights activist. He was an American angry at the United States government. A couple years ago, we had a man named Andrew Stack, I believe was his name, who flew a single-person plane into the IRS building in Texas. He was an American angry at the government, angry at the taxes. He wasn't protesting genetic engineering. He wasn't protesting factory farms. He was a white Christian American angry at the government, and he flew a plane into a federal building. So when we look at these other movements, they're full of lethal violence, and they're full of attempts at lethal violence. When we look at the animal rights and environmental movements, yeah, there are people in the world globally who claim some allegiance with an animal rights or environmental agenda and do engage in acts of violence, but this movement does not encourage that. This movement, that is not the tactics in which it utilizes. If you look at it quantitatively, it's nearly minuscule, and we can get into that later, but I've done a quantitative analysis of every single incident that's ever occurred, as far as I could find. And, you know, the incidents of lethal or attempted lethal violence don't even qualify as 1%. So when you have a movement that 99.8% of the time uses non-lethal methods, I think that's a pretty safe assumption to say that that's a movement that doesn't utilize violence.
So what differences do you see between these state responses to animal and earth liberationists versus other groups such as the right wing, you know, anti-abortion, anti-LGBTQ groups, right, et cetera?
I mean, it's strange the way that, again, I say the state, what I'm referring to is, you know, my state, you know, the United States government.
Yeah.
But the way in which the state chooses to kind of label and quantify these groups is, as I said in the article you quoted, you know, very, very asymmetric, you know. Going back to the point I made originally, it serves the state's interests. I would argue that the reason the United States government and the British government and the Canadian government and all Western neoliberal capitalist states target the animal and earth liberation movements more than, let's say, anti-immigration movements is because the anti-immigration movements don't challenge anything systemically in the country. The countries are already patriarchal, white supremacist countries. This is the culture in which we live in. So to be an anti-immigration activist, you know, to be the people who patrol the U.S.-Mexican border with, you know, automatic weapons and explosives, if you're that person, you're not challenging the state in terms of its systemic values, because the state is already anti-immigrant. The state is already, quote-unquote, patriotic in that sense. But when you're burning down a McDonald's and saying, A, private property is not enshrined in this sanctity of protection, and B, that what McDonald's is doing, you know, what the actual business is doing is detestable. When you're saying those two things, you are challenging core components of neoliberal capitalism. You're challenging speciesism. You're challenging private property. You're challenging what Max Weber calls the monopoly on violence. You know, the fact that police and militaries are able to commit violence, but citizens are not able to do things like burn down buildings. You know, you're challenging these really key and really systemic parts of what makes a nation state. But the white supremacists aren't doing that. The anti-abortionists aren't doing that. Yeah, they're annoying to me, and they're annoying to the government, and they're annoying to police because they're committing crimes. That's true. But they're not challenging the big parts of this country. I mean, even the anti-abortionists, you know, they're saying all life is sacred, but they're not challenging the fundamental structures which this country is based on. They're not saying all life is sacred, so we're going to bomb an abortion clinic and a prison with a death penalty and a slaughterhouse. They're not challenging it for systemic values. They're single-issue myopic movements. And once you move more broadly, I think the state gets scared in as far as states can, you know, have human emotions. I think that the state becomes fearful like that. You know, the United States government, since now over 10 years, has called the Animal and Earth Liberation Front the number one domestic terrorist threat. I like to pause for a second, let that sink in. That's an insane and utterly ludicrous statement when you look at the history of these movements. You know, you look at a movement that doesn't kill. You look at a movement that doesn't put bombs in businesses while they're open, like anti-abortionists have done, that doesn't sniper doctors. You know, if you look at the anti-abortion movement and the anti-vivisection movement, they both in some way target doctors and researchers. But in one movement, the anti-abortion movement, there's a long and regular history of doctors being shot and killed. And in the other movement, there's not a single instance of that ever happening. An animal experimenter, a vivisectionist, has never in this country been shot and killed by a demonstrator. That doesn't happen. It could happen. We're a gun-happy country. We have tons of guns and very liberal gun laws. But people aren't shooting vivisectionists, nor are the vast, vast, vast majority of people advocating shooting abortionists. But if you go on the Army of God website, one of the more militant anti-abortion movements, they advocate point blank the killing of abortion providers. They give you their names and their addresses and their photographs, and they say, kill these people. That is something we do not see on the Animal and Earth Liberation Movement. Yet despite that fact, these movements are targeted completely differently. The anti-abortion movement is seen as a nuisance, and the animal rights and earth liberation movement is seen as a movement of terrorism. And that asymmetry is, I would argue, to serve the government's larger kind of rhetorical goals.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, yeah, it's very interesting how we see that people may claim that it's a respect for all life, but yes, if you're willing to kill others for it, and it's funny how, you know, part of me in the back of my head is thinking like, oh, if you respect all life, why aren't you vegan, right?
Right.
So I'm really glad you brought that up. Now, you briefly mentioned how in, you know, Canada and the US and the UK, there's this interpretation of animal rights groups as being the number one domestic terrorist threat. I know that's definitely true in the research I've seen. Do you see any differences regarding the state responses to these groups between the various countries?
There's some small nuanced differences, but it's mostly the same, especially the U.S. and Canada. I mean, one of the differences is that Canada isn't as heavy-handed in terms of the terrorism rhetoric. In the United States, post 9/11, terrorism has been the boogeyman. You know, it's what the USSR used to be. It's what the Cold War used to be. The Soviet Union's gone, and you know, there's no more scary people in red, so we have to create these new people. And surprise, surprise, you know, they have turbans and beards, and they're not exactly Christian. So, you know, we've manufactured and created this threat. And I think that reaches many countries. It's based in the United States, and I think it's most prominent here. I mean, I live in Washington, D.C., and nothing's more exaggerated than it is in Washington.
Mm.
You know, the point where when Osama bin Laden was killed, there was a parade past my house, you know, at like 11 o'clock at night.
Really?
Yes, there was.
Wow.
I heard it from my window. But I think that the similarities are there. I think that the United States, Canada, the UK have a lot of similarities. The only thing that's really interesting to me out of kind of the differences there is in the way in which the United States is the lesser of the Orwellian bizarre states in terms of the United States and the UK. The UK in dates aren't my specialty, but I'd say 2004, maybe 2003, passed a law which criminalized the possession of materials that, quote, and this is like an open quote, glorified, incited, and encourages terrorism. Now, the United States always has this freedom of speech, First Amendment, real pride with that. So in that sense, the way in which terrorism is legislated against, you know, juridically legislated against, is different in the US and the UK. So for instance, Bite Back Magazine, which I'd encourage people to subscribe to and give money to and read, but Bite Back Magazine, which is a, you know, a pro-animal liberation front support magazine that documents this movement, that magazine certainly, I'm not a lawyer, but I would certainly argue glorifies terrorism. If you consider the animal liberation front terrorism, I would argue that that magazine certainly encourages and glorifies it. That being said, by the letter of the law, Bite Back Magazine would be illegal under federal law to possess in the UK, but not illegal to possess in the United States. I think in that sense, the way in which political violence has been legislated against is different. But what we see, and this is, again, I think of no shock, is that you have this law in the UK being used against people carrying pro-Al-Qaeda, pro-Hamas, pro-Hezbollah, pro et cetera, et cetera, movements, you know, Islamist jihadi movements. You don't see white leftist activists being arrested in the UK for carrying pro-ALF magazines. Now, there have been a couple instances. There was someone who was detained and arrested at Heathrow Airport for the possession of what was described in the media as pro-anarchist materials. He was denied entry and deported. There have been some instances. But when we see the kind of fight against terrorism in terms of these movements, we see that the United States, Canada, and the UK are doing something very, very similar, except the fact that the UK has this additional level of scrutiny where they've actually made it illegal to possess things that are only crimes in the way of message. And I think that that's an extremely troubling turn of events. And I think if something like that were to happen in the US, I would hope that it would be kind of the tipping point for people to be angry at their government, but I'm not optimistic enough that it would be.
That's very interesting because, I don't know, from a, we'll say, stereotypical point of view, one might assume that, you know, the U.S. is going to be really cracking down on this because, as you mentioned, like, terrorism is the boogeyman, so it's going to be greatly feared. What you're saying kind of reminds me of a couple local examples over here. For instance, there's student strikes in Montreal going on right now, and they've passed a law.
They passed mask laws and assembly laws. I saw that.
Yeah, exactly. And even more local here in Niagara Falls, there was a recent buying up of the land in front of Marine Land so that protesters can't organize there. It's just very interesting how those liberties are squashed, I guess, in the more subtle ways or whatever, but they happen here and in the UK just as much, right?
That's exactly right. And just to clarify, the law I was speaking of is, I looked up as we're talking.
Oh.
It's called the Terrorism Act of 2006. The letter of the law says it is illegal to, quote, this is clause two, to, quote, glorify, exalt, or celebrate the commission, preparation, or instigation, whether in the past, in the future, or generally, acts of terrorism. So again, it makes it illegal to exalt, again, whatever exactly exalt means, glorify, or even celebrate the preparation of terrorism.
Wow.
So, like, all these posters people have about, you know, like two people in balaclavas, you know, holding a map and a pair of bolt cutters. A poster like that, which is meant to, like, instill a certain sense of pride in a movement, that would be actually illegal to publish. That, to me, is scary.
Well, it really makes you think about past movements of other types, like civil rights and whatnot, like, just those comparisons. It's really startling. I was hoping next we could change gears a bit. I wanted to ask you a bit about your time in Palestine. Just first, I guess, a overall perspective interpretation of the conflict. I don't think in recent memory we've had someone who's been that close to the conflict on the show. So just sort of like your view of what's going on right now.
I spent three different times in the Palestinian West Bank, engaged in a number of social justice projects. The last time I went was in 2007. I attempted to go back in 2007 rather, and was arrested at Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, and after a rather short process, deported back to the United States via Zurich. So I'm actually at present not able to return. Unofficially, most activists who were deported have a 10-year ban, so I haven't been back since 2007. But during the time I was there, I engaged in, like I said, a number of social justice projects, ranging from collecting quantitative data for human rights studies to engaging in human shielding and accompaniment for nonviolent direct action movements that are Palestinian-led, Palestinian nationalist movements, also as well as some more traditional direct action components.
Hmm. Cool. In one of your papers, now you compare the state's reporting of attacks over in the West Bank with your own blog entries, different perspectives. I think it really vividly speaks to how similar incidents may be framed by parties with differing views or agendas, whatnot. So, first of all, would you like to kind of speak a bit for our listeners that may not have boned up on your...
So, I mean... One of the things I think a lot of people will see when you're kind of in a zone, and whether it's a demonstration in your own country or it's a car accident outside your house, you know, when you're a part of a news event and then you see the coverage of that news event, you kind of hope that those experiences ring relatively similarly. One of the more disturbing and disheartening experiences I had while working in Palestine was being present at a military operation. So, for instance, we got a call in the morning, you know, the Israeli military is shelling or demolishing or invading a community X, and we as a group, you know, arrive at that community and we spend the day, you know, attempting to reduce the amount of violence, to protect civilians, to help people escape their homes unharmed. And then when I see the reporting of that event on the nightly news, you know, again, the nightly Israeli news, not the international news, it doesn't even come up on the international news, but when we see the reporting of it, you know, that day in the Israeli press or maybe in the BBC or The Guardian, it was wildly divergent from what we had actually experienced. I have this one specific incident I can think of where in Jebel Shamalia, it's a suburb of the Palestinian city of Nablus in the kind of northern West Bank, the Israeli military had brought in Caterpillar excavators, you know, big crane-like machines, and they were attempting to force a Palestinian activist who they claimed was armed from his building. When he didn't leave, what they began to do is fire heavy automatic fire and grenades into the apartment building. When that didn't result in anyone leaving, they used the excavators to begin demolishing all of the buildings piece by piece from the outside in. They ended up demolishing a ring of buildings. I believe in the end there were 7 buildings they demolished, including an apartment building, probably destroying the homes for at least 150 to 200 people. And then they eventually arrested this man, which they were looking for. When that was reported at night, it wasn't reported as Israeli forces invaded the autonomous Palestinian city of Nablus, autonomous under the Oslo agreements, legally autonomous under Palestinian control. You know, that wasn't the story. The story was not Israeli invasion of Nablus. The story was armed clashes between Palestinian terrorists and Israeli military. Now that, again, was not what occurred. That was not what happened. That's not how anyone who was present would have reported it. But the people who are reporting the story weren't there. The people who are reporting the story saw some AP wire photos, but they didn't know the context. So they reported it as a clash, which implies some level of equity. You know, there's 2 people and they're on different sides of a barricade and they're both shooting each other. That was not what was occurring. The Israeli military was firing at a building and the Palestinian civilians were fleeing. And maybe there was an armed Palestinian side, I don't know, but they certainly weren't shooting back. So when you see something presented as a clash, which in reality is an invasion, you kind of begin to become disheartened with the ability for the news to report accurately anything. I mean, we, the social justice protesters, were fired on with live ammunition and with non-lethal ammunition, you know, quote-unquote non-lethal ammunition, many, many times while engaged in an unarmed, you know, non-violent, even non-aggressive demonstration. And we'd see the news coverage that night, and it would be the same thing. It would be, you know, anarchists and communists joined with Palestinian protesters and attacked Israeli military forces. It's like, well, no one attacked them. People weren't even throwing rocks. People were just walking with flags and maybe some instruments. So to be a part of that experience and then to hear that it's being portrayed as us attacking is, I think, extremely troubling and, you know, lends itself very poorly to getting a positive impression of the media. So what I reference in this article is exactly the same thing. You know, I look at my own writings in the moment, you know, being shot at, you know, being hit with shrapnel, being injured and being hurt, and then going home and immediately writing my reaction. You know, it's full of kind of anger and youthfulness.
Well, and especially anger, I guess, when you also compare that to the fact that you're seeing these reports that you clearly, like, went through and it was not like that. You say something similar regarding the assassination of Osama bin Laden and how the state labeled it a different way. I think they mentioned, you know, it was a firefight,
right?
And care was taken not to harm civilians, but if I'm not mistaken, civilians were harmed, yes?
Yeah, civilians were killed.
So what do you see as the, I guess, the effects of this statecraft propaganda? Because, I mean, it's existing in a variety of forms and for a variety of cases, right?
Yeah, of course. And I think the state will always craft itself as the good guy and craft its enemy as the bad guy. I mean, none of this is new. This is, you know, goes back to, you know, Napoleonic warfare or you know, Athenian warfare in ancient Greece. You know,
yeah, very true.
The state's going to make itself seem like it's right because, you know, one of the main challenges of statecraft is maintaining legitimacy. Even more so than, you know, killing and plundering your physical enemy is maintaining legitimacy amongst the populace. You know, if your population doesn't consider you legitimate anymore, then you have insurrection, and insurrection is problematic for a state because it usually ends in it not existing anymore. So one of the more interesting things to me in the United States is not, you know, how they arrest people and how they kill people, but how they maintain the veneer of legitimacy. So the Osama bin Laden example is a great one. You know, like I think I said in the article, Barack Obama comes on TV and says, you know, we killed Osama bin Laden, and expects everyone to cheer. And of course, many people did cheer. And I'm not saying that I'm sad Osama bin Laden's dead, but what I expected in that rhetorical moment was I expected the president of the United States to explain to the world why Osama bin Laden was killed, why he wasn't arrested, why that was the course of action. But that was not done. It was Osama bin Laden's been killed. The implication is you all know why we killed him. And of course, people know about 9/11. People know about the USS Cole. People understand that the crimes perpetuated by his organization. But the point is that Barack Obama, as the person who authorized his killing, should have, in my opinion, used that as an opportunity to provide some level of legal justification. You know, we claim we live in a legalistic world. You know, we don't just live in a world where the United States president can kill people. I mean, I know in the last few days, Obama has come on record as saying that he personally approves all the drone strikes. But personally approving a drone strike is also different than, let's say, for instance, convicting someone even in absentia of a crime. You know, I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with evidence being presented at a jury trial and, you know, defending witness and people being convicted and then, you know, whatever. I mean, that's much closer to a level of justice I'm comfortable with. But certainly putting someone's name on a list and killing them with a drone or sending in a quote-unquote elite group of Army Rangers to assassinate them in their home when they most likely could have been arrested, I think that's a bit outrageous. And I think that it speaks to America's arrogance much more so than its actual perception of threat. I can't imagine that those Army Rangers or whatever they were that were in Osama bin Laden's house really feared for their lives when this feeble man on dialysis did or did not pick up a gun and tried to fire at them. You know, I don't think he really presented a lethal threat in that moment. I think he could have been arrested. We seem to be pretty good at, you know, picking people up in foreign countries and putting a hood over their heads and dropping them in a plane and taking them off to rendition somewhere. I don't see why that wasn't done. And I've, you know, I think it's a more complicated reason why that wasn't done with Osama bin Laden, but I think that was the moment where the United States could have been the bigger person and said, you know what, we believe in justice, we believe in the letter of the law, so we're going to do this. But instead, we kill this person in their home.
I think that's such a great point that I remember when I heard the news, like, you sort of know on, at face value, like, of course, there's certain implications, but then you're kind of like, why did they do it in this specific way? Like, why did they kill him and not arrest him? Like, just going back for a moment, in terms of the freedom fighters in Palestine and how they've been labeled by their media, how might you compare that to the labeling of animal and earth liberationists here?
It's interesting. I mean, the way in which the Palestinian movement has morphed over the past century, since 1948, half century, has changed, certainly. And I think that the way it changed has been very interesting. I think it has changed in pretty tight lockstep with the tactics. So you see in the 1950s and 60s, the Palestinians are engaged in much more of traditional warfare. You know, they're the PLO, they're, you know, the so-called guerrilla movements. You know, it's hit and run ambushes and things like that. In the 60s and 70s, you see the rise globally of transnational terrorism, including in the Palestinian territory. So you have things, you know, like airplane hijackings and hostage takings. You know, you have what happened in Munich during the Munich Olympics. You have things like that, or what happened at Entebbe Airport with the hijacked planes. And then in the 80s and 90s, you kind of go back more to this small scale asymmetric warfare, you know, bombs and rockets and machine guns. So as these movements have changed, the ways in which they're described has changed. You know, one of the first things you learn in terrorism studies is that the term terrorism used to be, you know, originally was a mark of honor taken by the French during the French Revolution. And, it, you know, was we are terrorists because we inspire terror. And that you see that with the Palestinian movement, you have the use of the term freedom fighter, as you say. And for a while, you have them, you know, self-identifying as a freedom fighter. For a while, you have them self-identifying as terrorists. You know, both the Israeli, the Zionist militias that fought in the 1948 creation of Israel, as well as Palestinians. You know, you have people self-identifying under the terrorist label. So what's interesting is that those terms even themselves change meaning over the years. You know, the term terrorist goes from with the French being good to being obviously quite bad to in the 60s and 70s being kind of good again. And then in the contemporary post 9/11 world being quite bad, actually kind of the worst thing you can call yourself. What we see that's very interesting in the Palestinian territories is the changing nature of who is and isn't a terrorist. And that to me is the more interesting part of the statecraft. So in 2000 and I'm going to say 2007, as early as 2006, but as late as 2007, the Israeli state begins to develop sets of amnesties with the Palestinian Authority and basically says, if this group of people, you know, from a specific political party, in this case, the Fatah party, if they will agree to stop shooting at Israeli forces, that we will give them amnesty. They will no longer be wanted. They will no longer be terrorists. Instead, they will be folded into a new state. So what that means is that people who in the summer of 2006 were members of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the armed illegal wing of Fatah, they were quote-unquote terrorists in 2006. But by the end of 2007, they were no longer terrorists. They were cops. They were naval intelligence officers. They were presidential guard. They were whatever. There are different parts of the violent end of the state. You know, they were soldiers as much as Palestine has a military. So what you see there, and that was especially true in the area I was living in Nablus, which in 2006 was full of men with machine guns, illegal machine guns, you know, so quote-unquote terrorists. You know, the streets were full of men walking around with machine guns. But the same men, a year later, had a uniform and were now cops. And what you see is you see that when the amnesty was offered by the Israeli state, people went from being wanted by the state to being included in a new state. And of course, their title changes. I mean, the best example of this, which is in the contemporary really strange, but Zachariah Zabeda, who was the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in Jenin, who reportedly led the Palestinian offensive against the Israeli military during Operation Defensive Shield in the invasion of the West Bank, after he fought against the Israeli state and was a wanted terrorist for, you know, I don't know, maybe a decade, he was then completely pardoned and was, you know, out and doing his thing, you know, in the public sphere. And then only about a week or two ago was rearrested. The Israeli state publicly said, we are taking you off the amnesty list. They gave him amnesty and they took him off the amnesty. So he went from being wanted to being pardoned to now being wanted again. And that's just a stroke of a pen. It's, you know, I don't know in secret what Zachariah Zabeda did or didn't do to make himself wanted again. But what we see is that with a simple legal process, a public legal process, someone goes from being a terrorist to being a politician. And that to me is, again, one of the more interesting parts of statecraft, especially in the Palestinian arena, and especially in the past, let's say, 5 years since the amnesty program.
Yeah. So then do you see any similarities between that sort of table turning, I guess, when it comes to animal quote-unquote terrorists?
Not really. I mean, you don't see a lot of Peter Youngs and Rod Coronados and people like that, like becoming the president of the ASPCA and being patted on the head by the state. You don't see that. The closest you get to that is, I would argue, the case of Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherds and the case of Rick O'Barry, the guy who was profiled in The Cove, former trainer of Flipper the Dolphin.
Yeah.
Both of those people, Watson and O'Barry, are in a sense the good guys, you know, in the good protester, bad protester dichotomy. So both Watson's organization and Tim Berry have admitted to engaging in acts of illegality, which are typically called terrorism. So the Sea Shepherds have used explosives to sink ships. The Sea Shepherds regularly use, you know, boat ramming and all these different illegal actions, which are typically called terrorism. When, you know, Agenda 21 in Norway sinks a whaling ship, that's an act of terrorism. But when the Sea Shepherds, which, you know, they don't really do it as much anymore, but when they sink whaling ships, they weren't really considered the same way. Same thing with Tim O'Berry, or I keep saying Tim O'Berry, his name is Rick O'Berry. He has admitted to freeing dolphins in a number of countries. You know, he broke into a military installation in, I think, Guatemala, somewhere in Central America. And he, you know, he released animals. He released dolphins. That's an animal liberation at a federal military facility. If that were to occur here in the continental United States, someone were to do that, that would be considered definitely an act of terrorism. So I think that for whatever reason, O'Berry and Watson, the Sea Shepherds, are kind of given this pass. And it's interesting, you know, the Sea Shepherds have their own TV show on Animal Planet.
Yeah.
The Whale Wars. I mean, Whale Wars, to me, when I saw that the first time, that my jaw dropped. I said, I can't believe that the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, this group that is included in every single U.S. government report as an eco-terrorist group, they've got their own TV show. When the U.S. government makes a report about eco-terrorism, they include the Sea Shepherds. You know, they say the Animal Liberation Front, the Earth Liberation Front, the Animal Rights Militia, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, Earth First, you know, SHAC. They lump all these groups together. But on the one hand, they lump all these groups together as all direct action eco-terrorists. On the other hand, Watson is, you know, not in jail as a public official. Watson, well, actually, now he might be in jail, but not by the United States government. But, you know, Watson's given his own TV show. You know, the Sea Shepherds are given a very public venue to make their point. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is the closest you get to kind of this flip-flop flexible labeling, when you can have someone, you know, you can have Rod Coronado called domestic terrorist, but you can have Paul Watson called environmental activist. Even if he's seen as an extremist, he's still seen as a legitimate activist.
Just going back a bit to what you were saying about the reclaiming of the terrorist label, and to also segue to what I wanted to ask you about next. Your talk at this year's ICAST conference at Canisius College referred to a communique by the queer activist group Bashback. I'll just quickly read it for our listeners who haven't heard it. So, Bashbackers in support of autonomous animal action call for trans species solidarity with Tillicum. An autonomous cell of Bashback is calling for solidarity with sea criminal Tillicum, the orca responsible for killing a trainer at SeaWorld Orlando at the end of February 2011. We consider the attack on Don Branchow to be an act of social war, as Tillicum gave new breath to the waves he monotonously created through his awe-inspiring splashes. Tillicum destroyed what destroyed him by transforming his commodified body into an organ of the war machine, this enacting an Orcan strike. For too long, he had been confined as a spectacle for the American populace to consume. The effect of his bodily revolt has aided in helping us all realize the potentiality of reifying our underlying desires. Members of the American Family Association have come out in favor of stoning Tillicum to death for this strike against systems of domination. In response, non-human political prisoners at SeaWorld Orlando have organized the first chapter of Splashback, an insurrectionary tendency of sea animals dedicated to destroying all forms of oppression. Bashback must be allies in the struggle for animal liberation, as well as against the religious right, which has sought to criminalize the bodies of queers and orcas for so long. We are calling for solidarity actions with Tillicum across the country to support animal autonomy and resistance. Orcas have been criminalized for too long. The time for sea liberation is now. Solidarity with all trainer killers. So I was wondering if you could perhaps comment on this communique, and I guess the theme of this violent resistance and defense for the animal liberation movements.
I mean, the communique is interesting. I remember when it came out, and I was very, I found it to have a lot of resonance with me. So the communique comes out, you know, in one sense, as a piece of satire. I mean, a piece of pretty heavy-handed, obvious satire. The claim that, you know, orcas have formed a cell of an insurrectionary queer movement is not only extremely anthropocentric, but, you know, comical. It's not meant to be real, and I think that that's the first thing people have to kind of get, and not everyone gets that. But what I think this does, and I think this is what I spoke about in the article, is it kind of subverts the idea of passivity and resistance. So typically, you know, if you have these binaries, you know, human, non-human, white, black, male, female, straight, non-straight, on one side of these binaries, there is a violent individual who asserts its position violently. And on the other side is the recipient of that violence. So, you know, I mean, these are really obvious in the human, non-human, you know, humans have violence, they maintain their position violently, and they use violent force against non-humans. You know, obviously from eating to the SeaWorld enslaving example, what Bashback is doing, what the authors of this communique are doing, is saying that to be on the latter side of a dichotomy puts you in solidarity with all other people on the latter side of that dichotomy. So if you're a non-human animal, then you must be in solidarity with a non-heterosexual. You must be in solidarity with a non-white. You must be in solidarity with a non-male. You must be in solidarity, et cetera, et cetera. So it says, I mean, it says a number of things, but one of the things it says is that species, like race, like class, like sexuality, is a artificially constructed hierarchy that's maintained through force, domination, and coercion. And if that's true, then to be in solidarity with animals resisting domination inherently means that queers would be on the same side of that. Bashback comes from a different – from kind of the reverse of that, which says as a queer insurrectionary movement, if you're in support of us, if you're in support of queer liberation, you must be in support of animal liberation because all oppressed entities are aligned in this way. And I think that that is a really important contribution to intersectional politics. And this is kind of the social justice stick it in their eye part of the paper, which is, you know, people who consider themselves intersectional feminists or critical race feminists or eco-feminists or queer liberation activists or anti-racist activists or whatever, if you see that as a part of intersectional anti-authoritarian politics, then the only real logical extension to that is a vegan politic. And I think that anything short of that is hypocritical and self-serving. When people create their self-identities rhetorically, again, in the sense of like what is rhetorically okay, you can't self-identify, and I say this in the paper, but you can't self-identify as an anarchist homophobe or a feminist racist or a anti-racist classist. These aren't rhetorical categories that exist because they're ludicrous. To be a queer liberation ageist wouldn't make any sense. Because people – the obvious question is, well, if you're in favor of queer liberation, why wouldn't you also be in favor of youth liberation? So the point that the Bashback communique is making is if you're a queer liberationist, if you believe that oppression is wrong and violent hierarchies should not be kept against different species, then you must also be in favor of animal liberation. And that is an extremely important contribution because it's a contribution that is not reflective of the actual reality. You go to feminist conferences, you go to queer studies conferences, and I've been to all these conferences. You go to social justice conferences about the environment, and you go to the lunch table and it's full of meat and eggs and dairy. That makes no sense to me. You know, I recently spoke at the Southeastern Women's Studies Association, right? So it's the regional conference for the National Women's Studies Association. And I gave a paper on intersectional anarchism and queer theory. And, you know, I'm giving this basic spiel, which I'm giving to you right now. And, you know, we finish and we go outside and they're serving egg salad and cold cuts. And, you know, I'm in a room of people who are self-identified feminists, women's studies. And I'm telling them that if they find themselves to be, you know, women's liberation activists or queer liberation activists, they should be vegan because it's a logical extension of intersectionality. And that is not reflective of the actual world we live in. And I think that that's extremely troubling. You know, I've been to enough anarchist conferences that serve meat and dairy to be kind of annoyed by that.
Yeah, I agree. I'm really glad you brought that up. I mean, when it comes to solidarity, animals are often the last group, I guess, to be included in that. It's also kind of interesting because the way the animal liberation movements are perceived by those who aren't involved in it is that it's a single issue thing, right? That, you know, we love animals more than humans, right? Or non-human animals more than humans. So we're almost out of time, but just one last question. As we're talking about this intersectionality and social justice, do you have any suggestions, recommendations for further building that bridge and encouraging solidarity between the different liberation movements?
Like anyone who spends their time writing as opposed to throwing bricks, I hope that the things that I'm saying, the things that I'm writing contribute in some way. You know, I hope that that works. You know, I hope that when I've given this paper at the Southeast Women's Studies Association, when I've given this paper at a number of places, I hope that I make people uncomfortable. I gave this paper at two queer studies conferences, and people looked visibly uncomfortable because people don't like to be called out. So I think that I would encourage people to look at yourself, look at your movements, look at your collectives, look at your organizations, look at your networks, and try to make your politics an act of praxis so that your practice is informed by your politics. I think that that's very possible. You know, you wouldn't have a environmental studies conference in which, you know, everything was served on styrofoam and you took all the trash and you burned it in a giant pile. That would be ludicrous. You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't have a critical race theory conference that involved, you know, a game where you ran around and beat up immigrants. You wouldn't do these things because they would be ludicrous and seen as extremely hypocritical. So whether or not we're doing a conference or we're doing a demonstration or we're writing the next PETA ad, we need to make sure that people don't throw each other under the bus. We need to make sure that when we're making a PETA ad, we don't do that at the cost of sexualizing female bodies. We need to make sure that when we host a demonstration, you know, for animal liberation, that our chants aren't repeating and building on classist and racist slogans. We need to make sure that we actually build movements of solidarity as opposed to movements that leverage one movement over another. So, you know, we sell out the anti-racist activists in order to make progress in the animal rights movement. You know, a lot of anti-racist activists are completely turned off of even entering a conversation about veganism or animal rights because they see these posters in which it says, you know, a picture of a lynched black corpse and says, like, you know, slavery is the same as eating chicken. You know, that's not okay to a lot of people. So to actually build real networks of solidarity, not just lip service to that, to look at how our actions intersect with other forms of oppression, that'd be my hope, and that people could bring that into the various forms of activism they engage in, whether it's clandestine sabotage or it's university lecturing.
Wonderfully put. Thank you very much for being on the show. I hope we can talk to you again in the future and see what new stuff you're coming out with. So definitely stay in touch with us.
People who want to see some of these things that are in print, I try, as an active praxis, to make these resources freely available as much as copyright will allow for. So I use academia.edu just because it's a free service. So if you go to academia.edu and type in my name, you can find copies of most of these papers I'm referencing.
Yeah, it's a really great resource. So thank you. Thank you once again.
More than welcome.
That's all the time we have today for Animal Voices. Big thank you to our audio technicians, Neil Harvey and Aaron O'Sullivan, Taylor Book for her work with our social media, and Catherine Brigantino for letting me host today's show. It was really an honor. Animal Voices is produced and broadcast at CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines, and also broadcast at CIUT 89.5 in Toronto. You can also listen to us at 11 a.m. Eastern on iTunes Radio under the College University Radio Channel, as well as on Star Choice Channel 826 or Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946. If you have any questions, comments, or show ideas, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us by email at animalvoices@gmail.com, or feel free to get hold of us on our Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook social media pages. Thanks for listening.